So, Psalm 107. As noted there, the psalmist uses a number of images to describe the situation that people find themselves in because of their sin. However, in each case, when they cry out to God, their cry is heard. So here we're dealing with a very fundamental understanding of God in the Jewish system, that God is the one who hears the cry of the poor. That's absolutely basic. So when they cry out, their cry is heard. And God frees them. And the psalmist is calling the community to gratitude. And he concludes his psalm, which we'll come to at the end, of course. Let those who are wise give heed to these things and consider the kindness, chesed is the Hebrew, steadfast love, covenant love, kindness of the Lord, of Yahweh. Jerome, the famous Jerome of the translation of the Bible from Hebrew into Latin, and spent a lot of the time in the Holy Land. We know a lot about the places of the Bible through him. He inquired of the locals, and their memories are good, where this happened and where that happened and so on. Well, Jerome says, this psalm offers a synthesis of the human condition. Well, we'll see if he's right. Now, there are two refrains in this psalm, and I've indicated them by italics in your the translation I've offered you. And the two refrains that come in are, firstly, they cried to Yahweh in their trouble, and he removed from them their distress. Keeps echoing as a refrain. And the second refrain that comes in as a counterpoint is, they thank Yahweh for his kindness, for the wonderful things he's done for humankind. So assuring us that God hears our cry, and assuring us or inviting us to gratitude. So let's start our psalm. Give thanks to Yahweh, for he is good. His kindness endures forever. And as I indicate there, the opening verse of Psalm 106, 118, 136, and the refrain of Psalm 136, that's what it is. So it must have been a pretty common musical piece in the temple. And I remind you of the following from the prophet Jeremiah, chapter 33. The voice of mirth and the voice of gladness, the voice of the bridegroom and the voice of the bride, the voices of those who sing as they bring thank offerings to the house of Yahweh. And this is the voice, give thanks to Yahweh of hosts, for Yahweh is good, his kindness endures forever. For I will restore the fortunes of the land as it first, says Yahweh. Jeremiah lived at the end of the first temple, just before the destruction of Jerusalem and during the destruction. Did the psalmist pick up this from Jeremiah, and did it become a popular little verse for the use in the church, in the synagogue, in the temple, perhaps? Or did Jeremiah, is he quoting from a very ancient antiphon that had been sung in the first temple? I don't know, but obviously there's a connection. Verse 2 of our psalm. Say to the redeemed of Yahweh, and I think you know what the word redeemed means. To redeem means it's to do with slavery, and it's to do with freedom from slavery. So it's obviously a very basic idea in the Jewish concept, because slaves in Egypt were redeemed and brought to freedom. So it's applying to the whole nation. Say to the redeemed of Yahweh, those he redeemed from the power of the enemy, those he gathered in from the lands from east and west, from north and south. In the Isaiah scroll, the scroll that begins with the prophecies of the prophet Isaiah, but actually covers well over 200 years of literary work, there's from chapter 40 to 55, there's a section that was written by an anonymous prophet during the exile in Babylon. And the exile in Babylon is 200 years after, 150 years after Isaiah. But in that chapter 43 of that scroll of Isaiah, we read, "Do not fear, for I am with you. I will bring your offspring from the east and from the west I will gather you. I will say to the north, give up, and to the south, do not withhold. Bring my sons from far away and my daughters from the ends of the earth." After the destruction of the northern kingdom by the Assyrians, northern Iraq area, Ashur, Nineveh, that area, obviously they were carted into exile, and now they just had a second exile, and the prophet is saying God's going to gather all his children back to the promised land from north, south, east and west, and that's picked up here in verse 3 of our psalm. Then begins a series of sections which symbolized in different ways, the different ways of being lost, the different ways of being out of touch with God, the different ways of needing to be redeemed. And we go through them, and as I do, we might reflect on the New Testament as well and see how these symbols keep coming back into the literature. Verse 4, "They wandered in desert places, finding no way to an inhabited town. Hungry and thirsty, their soul fainted within them." And the first theme, refrain, "Then they cried to Yahweh in their trouble, and he removed from them their distress." Wandering in desert places, that obviously goes back to the 40 years of wandering in the Sinai desert area. This theme is frequently expressed, this theme of wandering in desert, in Deutero-Isaiah. And we think of the Hebrew starving in the wilderness journey. We also think, and in reflecting on Jesus and what he did to redeem us, inevitably go back to that image. And that's the image behind the story as it's presented of the multiplication of the loaves, the manna from heaven, and fully aware of all that, I'm sure. So they're painting Jesus as the new Moses, as the new one who takes us through the desert and feeds our hunger and so on. The letter to the Hebrews, or the oration, it's really a speech, not a letter, but it's to the Hebrews in the New Testament, chapter 11, verse 16, reads, "They desire a better country, that is, a heavenly one. Therefore, God is not ashamed to be called their God. Indeed, he has prepared a city for them, an inhabited town." They're not going to be left wandering. We're not going to be left wandering. We have a city. Paul will talk about an eternal city. We do not have here an abiding city. Our city is the New Jerusalem, and so on. But when we're wandering and lost, which can easily happen to any of us, God hears our cry, is the point of the psalm. Verse 7. "He led them by a straight way, and they reached an inhabited town." And then the second refrain that we'll see coming back, "They thank Yahweh for his kindness, for the wonderful things he has done for humankind. For he satisfies the thirsty, and the hungry he fills with good things." The Magnificat, isn't it? A bit, yeah. Isaiah 49, still drawing on that beautiful literature from that second Deutero-Isaiah, or the anonymous prophet of the exile, reads, "They shall feed along the ways, and on all the bare heights shall be their pasture. They shall not hunger or thirst, neither scorching wind nor sun shall strike them down. For he who has pity on them will lead them, and by springs of water he will guide them. Now, a second image for being lost or in need of grace. Verse 10. They sat in darkness and gloom, prisoners in misery and irons. For they rebelled against the words of God. They spurned the counsel of the Most High. Their hearts were bowed down with hard labor. They collapsed with no one to help them. And then the refrain again. Then, in this dreadful situation of being imprisoned, all the different ways you can imagine and realize being locked into some dark place, they cried to Yahweh in their trouble, and he saved them from their distress. Behavior has led to this. So you might think of addictions. There's all kinds of ways your mind can go now into thinking how we can get unable to move, locked in by parental whatever it is that's come to us, or just by our own behaviors brought us to an addictive, compulsive kind of place. Wherever we might happen to be, here we are. Now we come to the collapse. There's no one to help us. Yes, there is, he says. They cried to Yahweh in their trouble, but he saved them from their distress. There's a couple more references there to 2 Isaiah, verse 14, chapter 49. Say to the prisoners, come out, and to those in darkness, show yourselves. You might think of Lazarus. In the scene there where it's quite dramatic. Lazarus, come forth. And when Lazarus comes forth out of the tomb, the next line is so important. He says to the people around Lazarus, unbind him, let him go free. Often we're locked into a tomb because other people are binding us there, and they have to unbind us. They have to forgive. They have to let us go. You know, all of that stuff, which I don't need to develop with you, but we can keep other people bound, can't we? So we have the job to unbind people and let them go free. 52 of Isaiah, chapter 52, shake yourself from the dust. Rise up, O captive Israel. Loose the bonds from your neck, O captive daughter Zion. So we have to do something ourselves too. We just can't say to God, do it and God will do it. And God will do it, but there's a price to pay for any journey. So we mightn't be willing to pay that price. We mightn't be willing to take those steps. But we need to not only cry for help, but when help comes, we have to embrace it and the price that it costs us. So because of that cry, he goes on, verse 14, he brought them out of darkness and gloom. He broke their bonds asunder. So they've cried. Now, when God does it, second refrain, they thank Yahweh for his kindness, for the wonderful things he's done for humankind. Isaiah 42 again, reflecting on that. I have given you as a covenant to the people, a light to the nations, to open the eyes that are blind, to bring out the prisoners from the dungeon, and from the prison those who sit in darkness. That's part of that beautiful first song of the servant of Yahweh, it's often called. And that's the one that's quoted at the baptism of Jesus. You are my servant, my son, my heart, my beloved, my chosen one. My heart delights in you. Then it goes on. You meant to read it on too. You just don't read that little bit in the Bible. You go on and read the whole passage. And that's why the baptismal experience of Jesus was about mission. It was an opening of Jesus' eyes to see what he was to do. he was now ready to carry out his mission at the baptism, and so he begins his public mission, and that's described partly more beautifully, but that part there is about bringing people out of dungeons. And we're reminded of that scene in Mark chapter 5 where a bloke was in the Gadarene demoniacs, said so-called, funny words to use, but anyhow, Gadara is a place. Demoniac means he was mentally deranged, and everyone else locked him in and tied him down, but they couldn't tie him down, and Jesus brings him peace. We might also reflect on the trials that face us and the effects of sin in our lives, and I'm quoting to you now from Paul's letter to the Corinthians, first letter, chapter 10, where he says, if you think you're standing, watch out that you don't fall. No testing has overtaken you that's not common to everyone. God is faithful. God will not let you be tested beyond your strength. But with the testing, God will provide the way out so that you may be able to endure it. It's nice to have that by your bed when things are going too bad. I mean, you know, it's nice to believe that. And it's hard to believe at times and sometimes not, but that's the promise. And in fact, it's, well, everyone says this, of course, but we can always cope with the present moment, can't we? I mean, we're here now, we're coping. So we can always cope with the reality can always be coped with. That's probably too big a statement to make, but I'll just let it echo. Reality we can cope with. What actually brings people down is the imagined thought of the next moment. We just keep, our mind keeps imagining the worst scenarios, and they don't happen, and then all the worry that's gone into getting ready for them is wasted. You know what I mean? We're advised to live in the present moment in trust. Very hard to do, but a totally important thing to do, because we can always actually cope with now. It's only when we think the now is going to go on and on and on and on and there's no way out that we despair and go under. Well, there's a text that might help us do that. We'll never be tested beyond our strength. Verse 16. For, he says, he shatters bronze doors, God, cuts through iron bars. So they're not, was that Pope, was it? One of the great Catholics of the 17th century, iron bars. Stone walls do not a prison make, nor iron bars a cage. Interesting that the best poets of that whole period were, I mean, post-Reformation period in England, were all Catholics. It's amazing. Dryden, Pope? Dunn. No, Dunn wasn't. Dunn backed off it and was an Anglican. Like he just, yeah. He was a swinging voter, yes. But anyhow, it's just something there that's amazing, including Shakespeare, of course. They were sick because of their transgressions, because of their guilt, they endured affliction. They loathed any kind of food, and they drew near to the gates of death. It's another group now. Then they cried to Yahweh in their trouble, and he saved them from their distress. He sent out word and healed them, and delivered them from destruction. So in the New Testament, again, you see all these little aspects reflected in Jesus, in the way he healed the sick. He healed the sick is not such a good way of putting it. All healing comes from God, of course. But the healing came to people, and he kept saying to them, your faith healed you. He never said, I healed you. So he inspired an openness to God in people And when they opened to God, a lot of healing came into their lives, which it will come into all of our lives. And sometimes the healing, which is always a love thing, I understand as best I can, it's always love entering, and the love entering their lives sometimes brings physical healing and sometimes doesn't. And I guess that's something beyond my or anyone's ability. It's not a how you work that out, I don't know. But we do know that love is very healing, don't we? Love can be a very healing element. It won't get me a new leg if my leg gets chopped off, but it could. Healing my psyche can have a big effect on the body as well. Not always, but it can. And in Jesus' case, he seems to have provided the atmosphere of love and faith, which if people embraced it, did bring a lot of psychic, spiritual, and often physical healing into people's lives. Again, Isaiah, it was your word, Yahweh, that heals all people. He sent out his word and healed them. The centurion coming to Jesus about his servant, and he says, I'm not worthy that you'd enter into my house. Say but the word, send out your word, and my servant will be healed. Picking up the same theme. And verse 21, they thank, here it is, because they're healed, second refrain, they thank Yahweh for his kindness, for the wonderful things he's done for humankind. They offer thanksgiving sacrifices and recount his deeds with songs of joy. And now another scenario, as they say. They went down to the sea in ships, doing business on the mighty waters, and they saw the deeds of Yahweh, his wondrous works in the deep. For he commanded and raised a stormy wind, which lifted up the waves of the sea. They mounted up to heaven, they went down to the depths, their courage melted away in the calamity. They reeled and staggered like drunkards and were at their wits' end. And once again they cried to Yahweh in their trouble, and he removed them from their distress. Yahweh stilled the storm, and the waves of the sea were hushed. Then they were glad because of their quiet, because they had quiet, and he brought them to their desired haven. Heavens, if that isn't behind this scene from the gospel, what is? You know, the painting, the portrait of the gospel, presenting Jesus as Yahweh who has come to hear the cry of the poor through Jesus. God has reconciled the world to himself through Christ. And he's the one who brings calm to the storms of our life. That's what we're being told. And the painting that we're given, the portrait in the gospel, don't take it as a record of an event. It's a statement about Jesus. You must read the gospels. They're iconic. They're like icons. They didn't write the way we write. They didn't ask the practical, pragmatic questions we ask, and they were deeper than that, far deeper. So when they present Jesus there calming the storm, they had 100 memories of him calming the storm, not on the lake, whatever, but in their lives, in everyone's life. He was calming the storm on the cross. He was calming it. You know, he was constantly bringing peace to people's lives in the storms of their life. So. Here we read Mark chapter 4 verse 39, Jesus woke up and rebuked the wind. Jesus is in the boat, a good symbol, and a very early symbol and a constant symbol. We still use it, the bark of Peter is in the community. But Jesus is asleep. They know he's with us. We know he's with us. I am with you all days to the end of the world. But we're not, he doesn't seem to be listening. And that's what happens in the gospel scene. They're crying out and Jesus isn't hearing. God isn't hearing. No one's answering. No one's hearing my cry. And then Jesus wakes and He rebuked the wind and said to the sea, "Peace, be still." And the wind ceased and there was a deep calm. And then he says, "Why did you doubt, men of little faith? Why did you doubt that I would bring calm in this persecution in Rome?" As Mark is writing that gospel, Peter's just been murdered, Paul's been murdered, the community have been hung up on crosses and lit with tar and then torched as to give joy to the populace, all that dreadful stuff that was going on, and the whole community is feeling a mission of love, and that's what they're trying to do, and they're being treated like this by people who think they're to blame because everything's going wrong in the country and the fire of Rome broke out and they've got to blame somebody. So they the Emperor Nero sools them onto the Christian group, all this dreadful stuff. Well, it's dreadful, but they're being told to keep, God will hear their cry. Here's John's account, and you'll see quite close parallels to the psalm here, even closer than Mark. The sea became rough because a strong wind was blowing, and when they had rowed about 3 or 4 miles, they saw Jesus walking on the sea. You think of the crossing of the Red Sea, don't you? And you think of them walking dry shod with the water piled up on both sides. All that imagery is there. This is the Exodus happening. Jesus is able to walk to freedom across the sea, the chaos. And he comes near the boat and they were terrified. And he said to them, "It's I, ego eimi." The words taken from the book of Isaiah chapter 3 where God gives his name to Moses. This is the Yahweh. "It is I. Don't be afraid." This is the liberating God. Then they wanted to take him into the boat. And immediately the boat reached the land to which they were going. They were glad because they had quiet. He brought them to their desired haven. Jesus doesn't get into the boat in John. Interestingly, he does get in Mark. And he does get in Matthew. But he doesn't in John. You're looking at three different paintings. You don't have to kind of get them all agreeing with each other, like you don't get Marlowe and Shakespeare agreeing on Richard III. They're two different plays. They've got two different things they want to say. So here, John obviously wants to tell us, even though Jesus doesn't get into the boat with us in an apparent way, he is with us, and we will reach our goal. Anyhow. We're reflecting on the psalm, but I'm just trying to show you how surely the psalm has permeated the psyche of the community. And when they talk about Jesus' liberation, Jesus being God's presence liberating them, it's this imagery that floods back and that you find in the portraits of Jesus that are in the gospel accounts. It's our problem that we read them flat and as though they were photographs. That's not anyone's problem except ours. It's a modern problem, by the way. But that's where fundamentalism becomes a bit of a lack of intelligence, really, more than anything. So God does save them, save us in the storms of our life, and we will reach the goal. They thank Yahweh for his kindness, for the wonderful things he's done for humankind. They extol him in the congregation of the people and praise him in the assembly of the elders. So the congregation of the people, the kahal, is the assembly. I note there that this is the only time in the Psalms that the expression assembly of the elders, of the ancients, of the Greek will be presbyters, the elders who ran the synagogue. The older men whose responsibility it was to look after the religious management of the community. Now, another image which you're familiar with. He turns, verse 33, he turns rivers into a desert, springs of water into thirsty ground, a fruitful land into a salty waste because of the wickedness of its inhabitants. That's one thing. He turns a desert into pools of water. a parched land into springs of water. And there he lets the hungry live, and they establish a town to live in. They sow fields and plant vineyards to get a fruitful yield. By his blessing, they multiply greatly, and he does not let their domestic animals decrease. Jeremiah 23 comment, then I myself will gather the remnant of my flock out of all the lands where I've driven them, and I'll bring them back to their fold, and they shall be fruitful and multiply. Verse 39, when they are diminished and brought low through oppression, trouble, and sorrow, he pours contempt on princes and makes them wander in trackless wastes. But he raises up the needy out of distress and makes their families grow like a flock. The upright see it and are glad. They put a stop to all wickedness. But those who are wise give heed to these things and consider the kindness of Yahweh. And that's the conclusion of the psalm, but I did want to just offer a couple of parallel comments on it. So you see what he's done. It's quite good, I think, taking us through the different images, different ways in which we can be oppressed, telling us to cry out to God, and when God responds with gratitude, to acknowledge that grace. I want to read to you from the first book of Samuel, chapter 2, verses 1 to 8, which we alluded to earlier. This is Hannah, the mother of Samuel. It's her prayer, but you'll see in it, some of the New Testament images. So I'll just read Hannah's prayer. My heart exults in Yahweh. My strength is exalted in my God. My mouth derides my enemies because I rejoice in my victory. There is no holy one like Yahweh, no one besides you. There's no rock like our God. Talk no more so very proudly. Let not arrogance come from your mouth, for Yahweh is a God of knowledge, and by Yahweh actions are weighed. The bows of the mighty are broken, but the feeble gird on strength. Those who were full have hired themselves out for bread, but those who are hungry are fat with spoil. The barren has borne 7, but she who has many children is forlorn. Yahweh kills, and Yahweh brings to life. He brings down to Sheol and raises up. Yahweh makes poor and makes rich. He brings low, he also exalts. He raises up the poor from the dust and lifts the needy from the ash heap. And the Magnificat that we had in yesterday's Mass, in fact, is clearly based on that. God's power expressed in nature, which is part of the theme of our psalm. Just two references here that might attract you. Isaiah 35, firstly. And then the final words of the Book of Wisdom. Firstly, Isaiah. The wilderness and the dry land shall be glad, and the desert shall rejoice and blossom. Like the crocus it shall blossom abundantly and rejoice with joy and singing. The glory of Lebanon shall be given to it, the majesty of Carmel and Sharon. They shall see the glory of Yahweh, the majesty of our God. And the final words of the Book of Wisdom, chapter 19. The elements changed places with one another. Land animals were transformed into water creatures, and creatures that swim moved over to the land. Fire, even in water, retained its normal power, and water forgot its fire-quenching nature. Flames, on the contrary, failed to consume the flesh of perishable creatures that walked among them. nor did they melt the crystalline, quick-melting kind of heavenly food. For in everything, Yahweh, you have exalted and glorified your people. You have not neglected to help them at all times and in all places. God is preparing a place for those he has chosen, and we know from Jesus that God's love goes out to all. Those chosen are those who have welcomed the love offered them. Many are called, but few are chosen is a very dramatic statement of Jesus. It's not a, he didn't do any market research. He's just saying in his life, the fact is that few were answering the call. You're not chosen unless you answer the call, of course. Someone comes in and wants 15 people for a netball team, and only one person volunteers. Well, only one's chosen. It's not that the decision's being made at this end, it's being made at the other end. So many are called, many, the many, meaning not a little group. Jesus' call is going out to all, in fact. But only few are answering. That's the fact. And when Jesus died, there weren't many disciples. Most just ignored it or went the other way. And so it's not meant to be a statement about eternal truth, but it's a challenge for us. To be chosen means we have to step forward and say yes. So those who welcome his love. Genesis 2:8, Yahweh God planted in Eden in the east a garden, and there he put a man whom he had formed. And Psalm 68, rain in abundance, O God, you showered abroad. You restored your heritage when it languished. Your flock found a dwelling in it. In your goodness, O God, you provided for the needy. So our psalm is a reflection, obviously, on God's constant providence in our lives.